Welcome to Jonathan on Money, the personal finance podcast that brings you the latest insights and strategies to help you achieve your financial goals. I'm your host, Jonathan I. Shankman. On this podcast, we'll cover everything from investing, financial planning, retirement, and behavioral finance. I'll share advice and practical tips to help you make the most of your money. So whether you're just starting out or looking to take your finances to the next level, Jonathan on Money is here to help. Let's dive into this week's show. Welcome to today's episode. This week, we're going in focus where we explore more advanced wealth planning topics. Today, we're going to discuss the latest and greatest in aggressive tax strategies featuring Matthew Rappaport, Vice Managing Partner of Falcon Rappaport and Berkman LLP based in Long Island, New York. Before jumping into this week's program, keep in mind that you can follow all my latest content by subscribing to my newsletter. You can email me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com with the word newsletter in the subject line, and I'll add you to my distribution list. You can also check the show notes for how to subscribe to my newsletter as well. Today's show will cover a spectrum of available tax strategies and analyze whether a risk-friendly taxpayer should use them or should they be avoided. Matt will discuss techniques such as employee retention tax credit, conservation easement deals, intergenerational split dollar insurance, captive insurance, aggressive split interest trust planning, solar energy deals, and exploratory oil and gas. By the end of this episode, you should be better equipped to advise clients regarding these various tax-motivated transactions when they come up in the course of conversation. Today, we're privileged to hear from Matthew Rappaport, who's a vice managing partner at Falcon Rappaport and Berkman based in Long Island, New York. Matt chairs his firm's private client groups. He concentrates his practice in taxation as it relates to real estate, closely held businesses, private equity funds, family offices, and trusts and estates. He advises clients regarding tax planning, structuring, and compliance for commercial real estate projects, all stages of the business life cycle, generational wealth transfer, family business succession, and executive compensation. Matthew is known for his work on complex deals involving advanced tax considerations, such as Section 1031 exchanges, the Qualified Opportunity Zone Program, freeze partnerships, private equity mergers and acquisitions, and qualified small business stock. On a personal note, Matt is one of the most frequent and popular speakers at my program, and it is a pleasure to collaborate with him, given his deep knowledge and expertise. Today, Matt will be speaking about the latest and greatest in aggressive tax strategies. And with that introduction, I'll now turn the program over to Matt.
Popular. Yoni, popular? Are you sure about that? Listen, I'm not on video today because I came back from Capitol Hill like midnight last night. It's like I'm not video ready today. Not like anybody wants to see my face anyhow. So Capitol Hill was interesting. I'm actually going to throw some Capitol Hill content into this program because some of what I heard was relevant to today. But I am happy to speak with all of you about, and, you know, I wanted to do this topic because I feel like for those of you on the line who are tax advisors, wealth advisors, et cetera, you get the question all the time. Oh, hey, I have a windfall event. You know, I sold a business. I sold a valuable collectible. Like I sold artwork, or I just made a lot of money this year. And what is available to me? And for better or for worse, I've sort of compiled a little menu of things that I tell people, okay, there's different risk levels to each of these different things you can do. And in addition, there are things that I tell people not to do. There is a growing mountain of strategies out there that I feel are abusive, they're illegal, and they're going to get people into trouble. And I describe some of them on this program today, so you can watch out for them and you can ignore them. I heard about some of them when I was running around Capitol Hill yesterday, so I'll tell you about what Congress seems to think about some of this stuff. But there is a handful of strategies that I consider to be more or less on the in-between. They're aggressive. I think they work basically. I don't think the IRS is going to be amused with them, but every one of us has clients who they want to take the risk if it's disclosed to them, and they are just like that. They're risk-friendly. And they want to do certain stuff that as long as they can get an advantage and they can stay out of prison, they'll take the chances on things like penalties and all sorts of other consequences. And I'm happy to give them disclosures in writing about what kind of risk they're taking, but it's a risk nonetheless. So What this program will describe over the next 25 minutes is the stuff I've seen. And I'm going to go red light, yellow light, green light, basically, on all of this and let you know what my thoughts are. Because there's a good variety now. And I feel like the IRS still, after all the hemming and hawing, you have a lot of these debt ceiling deals that have cut off the Inflation Reduction Act funding that was supposed to go to the IRS and restore them to some level of firepower that could allow them to properly examine these things and enforce against them, and they still don't have it. The disclaimer is super important today. Please don't run around with this stuff and then start implementing it and then turn around and say, hey, oh, Matthew told me on that one webinar about it. Please don't do that. Okay, this is an informational presentation. If you want to email me, don't call me. If you want to email me and say, hey, do you know the person who is going ahead and implementing strategy A or strategy B? I am very happy to make an introduction for you. But don't run around and say, oh, yeah, I relied on Matthew's little program with Yoni at, 8:30 in the morning on April 18th, 2024. Don't do that. So, okay, let's get into it. ERCs. I still see these things floating around. They're so bad. The ERCs were part of the COVID-19 legislation that allowed a tax credit on really, in synthesis with the PPP loans. This was meant to keep employees on payroll during the COVID-19 periods, which were in really like 20, 21, a tiny slice of 22. And then basically, after that, you're not really eligible anymore. But the thing about ERCs, the bungled implementation of it was ERCs were open. And by that, I mean one could file an amended 941. You have to file an amended payroll tax return to claim this. The thing about the ERC is, again, it's all on the payroll tax. Like, a lot of people have the misconception that this comes from, your 1040 or, 1120S, 1065. It doesn't really come from that. It comes from the payroll tax returns. So when it comes to the ERC, right, you're amending your payroll tax return to claim this if you were eligible. And the thing is, there was an objective test, which was about a decline in gross receipts that was easy to measure. And then there was the more nebulous subjective test, which was whether or not a government order caused you to partially or fully suspend your operations. That is the one that's being abused. The decline in gross receipts test is pretty easy to measure. But the problem that you ran into was ERCs are now being, even with the moratorium that the government put in place on actually processing these, the ERCs became promoted. There were folks that were quote unquote consulting that were taking fees based on a percentage of the refund that came back off the amended 941s. They were sometimes going in there and preparing them irresponsibly. They were claiming that folks were eligible who were in fact not eligible. They were claiming that folks were eligible for more than they actually were eligible for. So ERCs became this enormous, enormous problem. And it became a multi-billion dollar fraudulent sort of thing. And I hope that everybody on the call is aware of how badly these things are being, frowned upon by the government enforcement mechanism, whether that comes from the legislative branch, the enforcement branch, everybody. They're so upset about how badly this got abused. Like I said, the IRS has put a moratorium in place on processing these. They're going after the promoters. Anybody who has gone out there and mass marketed, quote unquote, consulting for ERCs and going on the radio, going on television, going on the internet, and trying to solicit people sight unseen, those folks are going to get promoter audits. Every single one of those claims is going to be audited. And the IRS had a voluntary disclosure program that I believe recently expired. The IRS is considering reopening it. There was over $100 million of claims that in the voluntary disclosure program, folks gave back. The voluntary disclosure program for ERCs is really good and really generous. They said, keep 80% of the credit, 20% of whatever you got, you can keep. and you'll have no penalties, and you'll also have no interest, I think they said. And that was really good. Now, if they have to come find you and they have to come get the ERC money back, they are going to throw the book at you. They're going to throw everything at you. Interest, penalties, interest on the penalties. They're going to have you pay the refund back. It's going to be really bad. So I hope everybody knows enough to stay away from these things. But man, this has been promoted super duper heavily at great detriment to the overall system of tax fairness. Conservation easements. When these are done like the regular way, in other words, you have a person who, you know, she may own land. This is super popular, by the way, when you get to more wide open spaces, not in, you know, where most of us are in New York. Although I got to tell you, when you go out east, you go to the Hamptons, you got the Peconic Land Trust and stuff, they still love these things. But, you know, you go upstate, these are popular upstate too. But these are most popular, I've come to find, the Midwest. In big sky country, in places where there are wide open spaces, Texas, for instance, right? And you can have a person take a perpetual easement not to, you know, put any like meaningful human permanent activity on it, no development, no nothing, and basically put an easement that says we're going to preserve all of this land for nature. You can do it on part of land, you can do it on all of land, but generally speaking, whatever part you have, you can take a charitable income tax deduction for the appraised value of the land subject to the easement. And both sides of the aisle absolutely love this thing, both sides of them. The left loves it because it's environmental preservation, the right loves it because it's a tax deduction. Here's the problem. In Notice 2017-10, the IRS said we are observing a variety of this transaction in which a group of persons led by a promoter will get together in a tax partnership and invest a lot of money, leverage that money, purchase empty land, and then wait a year, place a conservation easement on it, and then somehow get an appraisal that the highest and best use is like four times what the purchase price was a year ago, and then take a deduction accordingly. That deduction is super valuable. If you put in $1, you were typically getting in these things in the most aggressive version, $7 to $8 worth of deductions, which were ordinary. $4 in your pocket, you get 4x your investment. Pretty good, except for the idea that the valuations were bogus. The IRS, in originally attacking these, tried to attack them on technical grounds. They had mixed success doing that. Now, what the IRS is doing is they're going after the appraisers and they're throwing some of them in prison. The DOJ announced an indictment and a successful indictment, I believe, of one of the appraisers involved in this, I believe in Georgia. And there will be others to follow. Syndicated conservation easements. Given the idea, I'll go to the next slide here just for you guys to see what the authority around this is. But given the idea that conservation easements are being so heavily enforced against, there are now some clever variations being put out by promoters. Some of them are doing what they call fee simple deals. So you'll get promoters coming at you saying, oh, no. We're buying the land and we're not donating the conservation easement so we get around the technical problems. We are donating the entire fee. In my estimation, it still requires a bogus appraisal, still requires way, way too much aggressiveness, and the IRS is going to go after those just as heavily as they've gone after their sister technique, the conservation easements. And these are bad. They're really, really bad. If you want to talk about Capitol Hill yesterday and running around these congressional representative offices, oh, they hate the syndicated version of this. They hate it. They love the regular version. Love it. They're not going to throw it out. You know, they don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. But the syndicated conservation easements, they cannot stand these. So Congress is angry, the IRS is angry, and I would not even touch these if I were any client who was seeking something to help out with my tax situation. Split dollar. Split dollar is interesting because split dollar, there are many varieties of it. I go over a couple of them in this deck, but split dollar, first off, it's got two general regimes. There is, I believe under Section 61, there's the economic benefit regime. The economic benefit regime of split dollar life insurance, right? In split dollar, the reason they call it split dollar is because there's somebody who pays the premiums and there's somebody who gets the benefit of the actual product. And those are two different people. That's why they call them split dollar, because you're literally splitting the costs and the benefits associated with the life insurance that you're placing. Very popular in business. It's very popular as an executive benefit. But split dollar has been abused various ways over the years. Notice 99-36 was all the way back 25 years ago now, but it said charitable split dollars really bad, whereby you would have a charitable vehicle go ahead and get the benefits associated with, paying the premiums that may have come with the policy, and then there would be a split of the death benefit between private party and the charity. And the IRS is not amused by this, and they came out and they said, "Yeah, we're not letting you do this anymore." The other thing that the IRS was not amused with was private split dollar. I will not, to protect the innocent, just because the practitioner who invented private reverse split dollar is still around, and I'm friendly with him, and he is an exceptionally intelligent, exceptionally capable person. He invented private reverse split dollar in an absolute genius move. And Congress was not amused. And then once they got wind of it, they passed a law prohibiting it. Private reverse split dollar basically took advantage of the idea that there would be a deemed gift or a deemed wealth transfer between generations if, say, a senior generation paid the insurance associated with a junior generation. Right. And there would be a deemed wealth transfer if you had a split dollar regime where the senior generation was the payor. But what if the junior generation was the payor and the senior generation benefited from it? The way that the deemed transfer between generations would work is that it would be the measured premium for 1 year of term life insurance on the insured. Well, if the senior generation is the insured, right? And you could get the transfer to go from senior to junior, right? The way the private reverse split dollar worked in a nutshell was there was a deemed transfer from senior to junior generation of the term life insurance cost for the senior generation, which was typically extremely high. Except the way that the split dollar regulations would work under estate and gift is that you would not have a negative transfer tax, federal transfer tax, meaning estate and gift. You wouldn't have a negative transfer tax consequence for that amount of premium. It sort of it flipped the intention of the split dollar regulations on its head, and it was super clever. Except the Congress was just like, they took one look at it and they said, we can't do this. So what is split dollar looking at today, right? Intergenerational family split dollar is not really about taking the cost of term life insurance and transferring it from senior generation to junior generation tax-free anymore. What intergenerational family split dollar does is it takes like a buy-sell agreement, for instance, in a family business, and it enters a split dollar agreement between senior generation and junior generation. It's typically loan regime. I think economic benefit regime, I think, is less popular now. It's loan regime, which is under Section 7872. And in an intergenerational family split dollar agreement, what will happen is, as part of that buy-sell agreement, the senior generation will pay the premiums to a trust for the benefit of junior generation. And the insured person will be the junior generation. And then what will happen is, right, well, let's just say mother is paying for insurance on daughter's life. The insurance is held in a life insurance trust, and the split dollar arrangement says that mom is going to pay the premiums. If that happens, right, you have an arrangement whereby, under the economic benefit regime, mom, is merely going to clock consequences according to the term life insurance cost on daughter, which is typically not that much because daughter is typically younger and healthier. Or under the loan regime, mom is deemed to make a loan and has to get paid back according to a stated interest rate for the premiums that are advanced. But when mom dies, right, what's valued in mom's estate is either the loan receivable under the loan regime or under the economic benefit regime, the right to get the premiums back upon the earlier of the death of daughter or the surrender or other disposition of the policy. So this is what the taxpayers did when they took a position around intergenerational family split dollar. They said that loan receivable or that economic benefit right should be discounted because you can't really value or you can't really take into account when the policy is going to be disposed of. You can have an actuarial estimate of when daughter's going to die, and it's really the latter that should control. And they took positions that the valuation discounts on these should be like 60%, 70%. And what this really was at the end of the day was a wealth transfer vehicle by which you need not use estate tax exemption, gift tax exemption, anything like that. And, you know, because if you have the right to get the premiums back in some way, shape, or form, there shouldn't be a gift. And that was set forth in the gift tax related regulations that govern split dollar. So taxpayers were taking relatively aggressive positions. If you paid $1 million in premiums, they were saying by the time the senior generation died, the value in senior generation's estate was like $420,000. I mean, something ridiculous. And Estate of Morissette and Estate of Levine basically tested this out. Estate of Morissette had really, really, really good facts. And the taxpayer in both Morissette and Levine won on all the technical grounds. In Morissette, the valuation misstatement penalty, though, was really hefty because they said there is no way the discount's that high. And I think on this one, you have to be really aggressive. This one, here's the way I use this one, because the IRS is not amused with this, and they're going in and they are really, really badly enforcing against this. If you have an aggressive client who's at the absolute last resort of, hey, what do? You can consider this, but man, do you need an aggressive client for it? Because between Morissette and Levine, the overall enforcement attitude, it is a jungle out there on intergenerational family split dollar. And it's a tough environment. So I would say proceed with great, great caution around this one. PPLI, Senator Wyden, famously, this is all over the tax press. Senator Wyden released a report on this. PPLI, what is this in a nutshell? PPLI is basically, could you take variable life insurance and then designate an investment manager to whom you are not related, and that investment manager can't be subordinate to you? But if you designate an independent investment manager and have that person place the money in the separate account of the variable life insurance policy, what would be the benefits, somebody asked, some devious mind asked, if you could take the variable life insurance money and you could place it anywhere you want, rather than just a menu that's put forth by an insurance company like New York Life or Northwestern or something? You look at a variable life insurance policy from a retail company like that, they'll tell you, well, this is the menu of stuff that you can invest in. Somebody turned around and said, well, what if you could invest it in anything? And in a nutshell, you know, PPLI takes advantage of the idea that under Section 72, the cash value, and you know, any return you get on the cash value of the insurance is generally not taxed as long as you structure the policy the right way. Senator Wyden did an investigation. And in my estimation, Senator Wyden's, which was in February, by the way, that he came out with the report. He gave subpoenas last year, and then everybody complied, and he came out with the report. The problem is that Senator Wyden subpoenaed like only the largest providers, which were doing the most conservative things with this. I've seen some really crazy stuff get done with PPLI, and in my estimation, Senator Wyden's report doesn't really scratch the surface of what is going on in this arena. I like PPLI for certain people. I like them for people in the financial industry where they are risk friendly and they typically invest in their friends' funds, and you know, their friends already have vehicles that can accept life insurance money. You have to set up a special vehicle in order for variable life insurance money to actually go into private equity or a hedge fund. But a lot of those private equity and hedge funds have smartened up and they've set up those mirror vehicles and they allow people to invest through these types of policies. The advantage of this is that any investment that's done through a life insurance company, you know, there's no current taxation on any investment returns or growth in the investment value. And then by the time that one dies, you know, Section 101 says that as long as you haven't had a transfer for value during life, the proceeds are paid out to the beneficiary without taxes. This is good for aggressive clients. It's got to be used the right way. And there are things that people are doing in order to get more exotic assets into the cash value portion of the life insurance policy that are like really high flying that I'm not sure I agree are actually kosher. So the vanilla providers, the larger providers, I think they're doing stuff that is pretty good. And Ways and Means, by the way, when I was visiting with Ways and Means yesterday, there is no proposal to act on Senator Wyden's report. So even though Senator Wyden is angry and he's brought it to the public fore, this doesn't seem to be changing. Captives, especially micro captives. I mean, these are out there, but man, micro captives, they hate them. Regular captive insurance is really good. Captive insurance under Section 831B, it says you can get like a $2+ million maximum deduction for premiums that you pay to an insurance company you set up for your own business. You know, they call it captive because at the end of the day, it's now a related company cluster. I have an operating business. This works really great for like waste management, private medical practices, construction, manufacturing and distribution, food and beverage. This works great because their insurance costs are off the wall. And if you use captives right, you can get a tax benefit while also getting a financial benefit while also getting an insurance benefit. It's very powerful. The problem is it has to be designed responsibly. If it's designed as a micro captive, the IRS hates it and Congress hates it, and they're just going to hit you over the head with a sledgehammer. But if you lead with the insurance need, this is really awesome. I mean, it just is. And you just have to make sure you're setting it up with a responsible provider. But yeah, I still like captives in the right situation. But man, these micro captives are super toxic, and that gets a red light for me. Shark fin clads, I like shark fin clads. They've become more popular recently. You know, this is a strategy whereby if somebody has a major income tax event, you set up a shark fin clad, and what you're doing is you are pushing the you know, money you would otherwise pay in income taxes toward premium that can pay into a life insurance policy that's going to benefit your heirs free of income tax, estate tax, and gift tax. And mathematically, this thing's set up so that the only way it can fail is that a very highly rated insurance company doesn't pay the death benefit. Otherwise, you get about, I would say, in the aggregate, maybe half the money in this vehicle on average. You know, it's going to depend on a number of factors, the age and health of the insured, the IRS tables, and how you punch the numbers into the IRS tables to design this thing. But, you know, look, it's a regular CLAT, except it follows some literal language in a 2007 revenue procedure, and it generates a charitable income tax deduction that's usable for up to 30% of AGI for the year you implement it. You set this thing up as a grantor trust, you get a nice income tax deduction, you get a nice benefit for your heirs. Just works. I like it. I am, you know, if you want to talk on circular 230 levels of confidence on this, I'm going to should level of confidence on these things. I like them in the right situation. I think they work. You know, for a lot of clients, they want the benefit to go in their pocket and they don't want it to go to their heirs. But for clients who are out of exemption or just really care about estate planning and have a big income tax event, these things work really well. So I like them. These CRAT transactions, this is like, I've never seen these. I've seen CRUT transactions that are really bad. I've seen CRT transactions where the taxpayer will give up the charitable deduction so as not to have the self-dealing rules apply and then go ahead and put a bunch of assets into the CRT and then start, you know, put an LLC underneath the CRT that's owned 99% by the CRT, 1% by the taxpayer. Then they borrow stuff out of the LLC. That's abusive. I don't think they're referring to that based on what these regulations say. But these, I've never heard of these. I don't know anybody who's heard of these. I've seen things in the tax press where people are like, I don't even know where these things are going on. But the IRS was so angry about them, they started passing regulations, which was like crazy. And they don't, I don't know. If anybody's seen this, I would love to get an email from you, but I've never seen the CRATs out there that they're talking about in these regulations. This is part of a category here of like, oh, if syndicated conservation easements are really bad, what can I do to start generating income tax deductions on a leverage basis? Exploratory oil and gas, you can do it. It's a really risky financial investment. These things tend to go bust, but you can leverage these things and you can get into them. And then solar. The problem with solar is it's very tough to get around the passive activity rules. Oil and gas, you can get around the passive activity and at-risk rules because there's special rules for oil and gas, not so much for solar. In addition, I've got somebody doing a car wash fund with a lot of accelerated depreciation. If you're interested in that, I can put you in touch. And again, you got to get around the passive activity rules. You got to get around a couple of other sort of things. But people have come up with really clever designs for this. And I'm also aware of an equipment leasing deal that's pretty nifty. So there's a cluster of like four of these that'll get you some decent deductions. Promoters of a lot of stuff now have really high-powered lawyers because of how much money they're making. So notice 2007-83, abuse of welfare benefit plans. Mann Construction was an abuse of welfare benefit plan. And then they went ahead and did a collateral attack on the listed transaction regulations, and they won. So now all of a sudden, right, I went back to the abusive-crat thing. They came out with regulations. That's what they have to do now instead of the listing notices because of this Mann Construction case, which is crazy, right? So what did they do in regs? They did a reg against the intermediary installment sales. If you'd like my Bloomberg article on this that I wrote in 2016, you can send me an email and I'll send you a PDF. These are so bad. Their promoters coming in and saying, oh, do you have a large sale event? Then what we can do is we can step in with our company. We can step in the middle of the buyer and the seller. You, the seller, will sell the asset to us. It could be business, it could be real estate, it could be artwork. Sell it to us. We'll give you back an installment note. You pay taxes in installments. We'll turn right around and we'll sell that asset at the same cost to the ultimate buyer. And the service is not amused with these. The promoters are all getting audited and all their client lists are getting turned over to the IRS. These are so bad. There's a red light on these. I hate these. So anyway, I hope this was helpful. It's always tough to squeeze these things into a half an hour. I'm turning this back over to Yoni, who I will thank for having me as always.
Great. Thank you so much, Matt, for those informative insights. As Matt was speaking, one thought that popped into my mind is how some clients are so eager to save on taxes, but not all of them appreciate the risks associated with more aggressive tax planning. Every decision in life has trade-offs. This is also true with investing, financial planning, and tax planning as well. It's important to consider the pros and cons of every tax planning decision and go into it with eyes wide open. And with that, it's a wrap for this week's show. Any comments or questions, feel free to reach out directly to me via email. I love hearing from my listeners. And if you enjoyed the show, please rate it on Apple and Spotify. This will help other financial enthusiasts find the show as well, and I'll be very grateful. And finally, as I end every episode, the secret to financial success is no secret at all. It's to spend less than you make, invest the difference prudently, and ignore all the noise. See you next time on Jonathan on Money. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. I hope you were able to take away a nugget or two to apply to your own life. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so you can be alerted whenever new episodes drop. If you'd like to submit a question that may be answered in a future show, please email me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com. Be sure to check out all Jonathan on Money content, including all of my articles, webinars, and videos by following me at Jonathan on Money on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Finally, if you like what you heard today, please rate the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This helps ensure that other personal finance enthusiasts can find the show as well. Thank you, and catch you on the next episode of Jonathan on Money.